the reason these disturbances, they followed you to a new home, is because it's not the house that's haunted. It's your son.
So 1,100 men went in the war. 316 men come out. The Sharks took the rest June the 29th, 1945. Anyway, we delivered the bomb.
Never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, say, I'll be right back. Because you won't be back.
You get another beer, you want one?
Yeah, sure.
I'll be right back!
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Oh, shit.
My name is Robert Hawkins. Approximately 7 hours ago, something attacked the city. You found this. If you're watching this, then you know more about it than I do.
California, stay away from me. Stay away from me. I'll come in here. John Doe has the upper hand.
And on that day, Ahab will go to his grave, but he'll rise again within the hour. He will rise and beckon. Then all save one shall follow.
They're all gonna laugh at you! They're all gonna laugh at you! They're all gonna laugh at you!
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I'm one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how's it going?
It's chaotic.
Indeed. And in the state of New York?
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how are you?
I'm awake. How are you?
Yep, same here. Had the energy drink, a cup of coffee, all that good stuff. And in the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Hey, this is Barrett.
Barrett, how are you, sir?
Good.
Excellent. For folks who are curious, today is September 2nd, 2021, and we are recording this for some listeners that are curious when we do record, because we don't necessarily release these episodes the very next day. So, Pam, 9/2/2021. And with that stated, I guess we can get into some of the house cleaning, which is darkdiscussions.com is the website. It's updated daily with news, podcasts, release notices, and all sorts of other things. So check it out every day. It should be one you check out every day for sure. Also, we have a Facebook group, Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, and you can email us at darkdiscussions@aol.com or press the contact us on darkdiscussions.com, and it will create a email just as if you were typing it in your own email system. We will read your email on the podcast. So if you have suggestions, you have opinions on one of our topics, if you have feedback, if you have a movie that you've seen that you just want to give your own 3 to 5 minute review or whatever, just email us over and we'll read it on the podcast. So I think that's pretty much it. For folks who are curious, we just recorded our or released our 500th episode of Dark Discussions Podcast, which is the, I guess, the original headliner podcast of the network. And we have been around now for 10 and a half years. So anything anybody wanted to bring up before we begin? Anything?
What have I done with my life?
Indeed. It's like I closed my eyes and yesterday I was 26. What the hell happened? I just had my.
I was just listening to the Pink Floyd song "Time," and that pretty much sums it up.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, I did one of my football drafts yesterday, the one that I run, and I was talking to my buddy Aaron. He flew in from DC because the league is that competitive that we have people from all over. And he said the same thing. He goes, dude, what the hell happened, dude? Just yesterday we were 25. And it's like, I know.
It's terrible.
Surprise. Yep. We did old like a month ago, guys.
Yeah. Indeed. And speaking of birthdays, happy birthday to Mike, who just turned 51.
Yay.
Wow, yay. He's really old.
Yeah. Yeah. School started. It's weird because it's like I walked out of school. I was 49. I walked back. I was 51. Somewhere there was 50. I don't know what happened.
Yeah. My 50th anniversary or whatever, 50th birthday party, whatever you fucking call it. It was canceled. I don't even remember.
Anyway. Where am I?
That's right. And my father died of COVID, so fuck 2020 and 2021. They
yeah.
the worst years
yeah,
of my
they
fucking
can suck
life.
It.
Yeah, these years suck. Anyway, I guess we can get into our topic tonight and be more happy about seeing people
it's
get
much
killed.
More cheerful.
Seeing yes, people exactly. get killed, yeah.
So let's begin. And Eric, what are we going to discuss tonight?
Tonight we're going to be talking about the new release currently in theaters. Candyman.
The urban legend is, if you say his name 5 times while looking in the mirror, he appears in the reflection and kills you.
Who would do that?
Candyman. Well, we're still alive.
Let's go. Trina, you've broken the door. This isn't funny!
I feel really connected to this neighborhood. Cabrini Green. It was the projects. I just moved there, around the corner.
The old candy factory.
I'm an artist.
You're looking for Candyman. He's the monster that's part of this neighborhood.
Why are you drawn to this?
I'm hoping to spread the story all about Candyman. The mirror invites you to summon him. You should say his name. I dare you.
Candyman. Don't say that.
Candyman.
I think I made a mistake. I brought him back.
Candyman isn't real!
Something's happening to me.
He had a purpose for you, to be another one of his terrible stories.
I guess he found me. I am the writing on the wall. The sweet smell of blood. Be my victim.
That's right, Candyman. Fortunately, we only said it twice, but this film is
four times.
Yeah,
there you go. So this film...
Unfortunately, Christy and Abe are not here.
So this film here was a film that was supposed to come out, I think, last year. I mean, whatever, COVID pushed it back, like every other film. No one knew what it was, whether it was going to be a remake or just part of the franchise. We'll discuss that as we get into our review. The film is directed by Nia DaCosta, who has been pretty well received from some prior films that she did, specifically Little Woods, that got really good reviews, some kind of indie type film.
And yes. Just since you're talking about her, I just want to mention, I can't remember the last time I've seen a director rise in the industry this dramatically. She went from her project Little Woods, which I believe was a Kickstarter project, and then she did this, which is a sequel to a very well-known horror movie. And her next one's going to be a Marvel movie. she's skyrocketing up the hierarchy of
at this point. I got one bigger than that. I got a bigger one. And you ready to hear it?
Taylor Swift biopic?
Nope. It was a film that came out last year that won Best Picture and Best Director, Nomadland, Chloe Zhao.
Yeah.
Came out of nowhere. And she is at the top.
No, I'm just saying. Yeah. DaCosta, she's going places.
Yeah.
But the thing is, the Marvel generally goes cheap on directors, hires up-and-coming directors, and then the directors will do them knowing they can then use that as a stepping stone to bigger films.
Right. Indeed. And she's taking that stuff.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, it makes – so she fits – she's fits. I'm saying she fits perfectly with that. It's not like Star Wars where they tend to go with big-name directors.
Mm-hmm. Actually, you know who else pulled this off too that was pretty awesome? Was John Watts, the guy that did Clown. He does Clown as a joke, as a, you know, trailer. Eli Roth likes it, produces the film, and then he's doing Spider-Man.
Yep.
That's fucking awesome.
That's a pretty good one, too.
Oh, another good one. The guy that did the Evil Dead remake. He made a 5-minute short on YouTube, and Sam Raimi liked it and hired him for Evil Dead.
Or nice. Or how about Scott Derrickson, who was a blogger on Ain't It Cool News, who ended up doing Sinister and then doing Doctor Strange.
That's right. Yeah. Well, and guess what? The guy that wrote Sinister and Doctor Strange was just a movie reviewer. And
that's
guess
who I was talking about.
Oh, no, that's not Derrickson. That's okay, Cargill. That's Cargill.
I was trying to point out that neither guy.
Cargill. Okay. Yeah. Sorry, I got the name.
He's quite successful quite earlier in her career.
Yeah, Derrickson was the director. You were talking about the screenwriter. Yeah.
He really started something.
And you know what? Yeah.
DaCosta, the one who directed the film we're talking about tonight.
Sure, sure. But I used to watch Cargill on my very first podcast I ever watched. My
okay.
very first podcast was Cargill's podcast, and even before Horror, et cetera. Anyway, let's get
Candyman.
Into Candyman. Yeah. So Candyman, that's right. So we're talking about Candyman stars Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, who I think is a British guy, Teyonah Parris, Nathan Stewart Jarrett, Coleman Domingo, screenplay by Jordan Peele, Wynn Rosenfeld, Nia DaCosta, produced by Ann Cooper, Wynn Rosenfeld, and Jordan Peele, and most certainly the person that has to be mentioned is Robert Lowe, or known as Likens, the musician for the soundtrack, because I believe the soundtrack was pretty solid.
And by the way, Phil, I looked it up because I actually did my own little YouTube review on this.
Yeah,
is how you pronounce that actor's name.
You didn't send me the link, or did you?
No, I didn't actually. I wanted to wait until after we did this.
Gotcha. So that's fair. That's fair. So, there you go. Yeah, right?
Yeah.
So,
You just say it real fast.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So the film is getting good reviews. It's around 80% or so. If reviews matter to you. That's pretty much all I got. So I guess we can get into how we heard about this film and what we thought about this film. And so let's start with you, Eric.
I don't remember how I first became aware of this film. I'm sure I knew about it before last week, but I generally try and stay willfully ignorant of any new release schedule because that involves trailers. So I just, every week I check and see what's coming out on Friday, and this was coming out on Friday. So I was like, yeah, sweet. So I went and saw it. I really enjoyed this film. I thought it was very well made. It has some themes that some people are having issues with. We'll get into that when we talk about the movie. I think Nia DaCosta, deserves her rise in popularity in the industry because she's a good director. I also thought the acting was well done in this movie. The soundtrack was solid. There was also something in this movie that I'm gonna call it shadow puppets for lack of a better term, but it's not like people with their hands in front of a lamp. It's actual like cutouts being used in this movie in a very interesting way. When people are giving exposition, they will often depict what is being talked about as kind of a shadow play, which is really interesting to me visually. And then they also have one at the end of the movie while the credits are rolling. And I recommend sticking around to check those out if you go see this movie. So I think this movie was really good. I highly recommend it.
All right. Sounds good. For me, I have no idea how I heard about it. It was just one of those things that people were talking about that they heard that it was coming out last year before it wasn't coming out last year. And so I forgot all about it until Eric said, Candyman's out this week. Is that the next topic? I go, oh, yeah, let's do it. So, yeah, I saw it, I think, Tuesday night. Yeah, Tuesday night, because I didn't have any of my multiple fantasy football drafts. It was the only night I could do it. So I went and saw it at our local dinner theater. And, yeah, it was pretty good. It was solid. I enjoyed it. The first 15 to 20 minutes, I was getting a little worried, but generally the film was pretty solid. I didn't feel it was that scary or creepy, but it was good enough. I think the thing that makes it really good is the music, because that kind of kept the tension a little bit going. I'm not necessarily a big fan of the first film, the classic. So the franchise really isn't anything that really interests me. But all in all, it's a good film. I would recommend it, especially if you like the franchise. Just be aware that some people who go and see it who love the first film, I've seen it already on Facebook, people saying, this movie sucks, it's not like the realm of Candyman, where's Tony Todd, and all that crap. So,
yeah, well, those people will always come around.
Indeed. So, it was good. I wasn't a huge fan, but I enjoyed it. It was a solid film and very well made. Let's go with you, Mike.
Yeah, I've got a weird thing with this film, because I think, Phil, you hit on my issue with it, which is that it is not in any way creepy or scary. It, I think, pantomimes it. I think it completely misses the mark on the atmosphere. I think it misses the mark in the story that it's telling. I think it starts with an assumption of this is a thing that's bad, and we want to make it about a bad thing, and everyone's going to like the fact that we make a thing about a thing that's bad, but they don't really do a lot of legwork with it. I think this stuff kind of happens more or less off screen. So the horror of it doesn't work. I think not that it's like, well, this isn't Candyman. It's not my Candyman kind of thing, but you are making Candyman and you're dealing with an iconic image. And like, it's kind of like you got the Wish version of Candyman when you do see Candyman, meaning like the classic, it's a very kind of creepy, disturbing image. And here it's just a guy in a coat with a hook hand. It's just, it lacks the gut punch and it lacks the creepy factor. I think a lot of it is just the fact that you are watching a guy wandering around in gentrified neighborhoods that are well lit, as opposed to, when in the first film you're dealing with someone who is completely out of their element in these terribly rundown, decrepit neighborhoods, which just added more atmosphere to it. And I think this is really missing the mark on a horror atmosphere. A lot of stuff I really liked, and I really liked the beginning of the film. Was really pulling me in. I think a lot of the imagery worked well, and I do think the performances are great. I think like the shot composition and cinematography are good, except they're not. Like, as the film goes along, you should have been cranking the horror up, and it never really gets there. It feels more like it's somebody's making a thing is what they think a horror movie is supposed to be without actually understanding the horror film. The whole scene in the bathroom completely lacked any tension for me with the five girls in the bathroom. There's a half a second of Tony Todd in there, which I guess, whatever. If that was a bone to the fans, it was a weird one. But it's just... And I didn't have a problem with them playing around with the mythology, which we'll talk about. But yeah, it's strange thing. I liked a lot of things about the film. Fundamentally, I think it missed what it was trying to be. And the best I can say is I just got to give it a mild recommend then, if it's just something you're interested in.
All right. Sounds like you're right on with me. Barrett.
I really like this film. I totally disagree with Mike. I thought the scene, I thought the imagery and the cinematography worked really well for the horror aspect and creepiness for me. I really liked the use of mirrors. And I thought it worked well with the mythology of the first one. They did a good job of tying them together. And the music score was really well done, and I thought the acting was really well done. So I really enjoyed it. I'd give it a high recommend.
So, Eric, do we have a wiki?
Wiki, wiki! A sequel to the horror film Candyman 1992 that returns to the now gentrified Chicago neighborhood where the legend began.
All right, I like that. That doesn't spoil anything.
So, right. So
good enough for me. All right, so anybody want to add to that wiki? Anyone?
Well, I'll add to the fact that there were a lot of people. I think this is one of the better trailers that they've released because they do use the shadow puppets a lot. And it tells the story of Candyman as the guy that starts the movie off, which got a lot of people get their dicks in a bunch because that's not the Candyman story. Why are they changing the Candyman story? That's not Candyman. Why are they remaking this Candyman to be woke? That's stupid. Which, again, they, A, missed the point of Candyman and the point of the original film.
That's actually one of my big gripes with some of the reactions to this movie.
And they of course, also didn't do the thing, which is, watch the fucking film so you know what you're talking about. Because that would answer all of your goddamn questions. This did what a trailer should do, which is not show you everything. It showed you the setup, and that's it.
As Eric says, F trailers.
It's not the trailers. This is the morons who don't know how to watch one.
Well, that's a fair distinction. I still think they showed a couple things in the trailer that I'm glad I didn't see before the movie.
Well, and I think I was talking, might have been Holly Maciak I said this to, or but it's when they say they'd show too much, if you watch trailers from back in the day, they showed as much and sometimes if not more. The difference is they didn't have them at their fingertips to watch, rewind, scrutinize frame by frame
the way
we do now. Zoom in, reflect, yeah, you know, it's
What symbolism are they showing in that scene? We can zoom in on that and catch that, and what's that?
Oh, that's it.
Yeah.
You know, within, you know, so they dropped, like, the Spider-Man trailer last week, and, you know, within, by the end of the day, there's 400 things on YouTube analyzing and breaking down every, like, frame of the trailer. It's like, watch it once. So, like, Eric, I know you said, you know, so I don't know what the things were they spoiled in the trailer, because I watched the trailer once. What?
How much of a math of the spoiler flood?
Okay. But I don't remember it. You know why? Because I watched the trailer once, and that was it. I didn't watch it. Oh, that's good. That's creepy. I didn't watch it again. And whatever it may have spoiled, I didn't remember. That's kind of how you should be doing it.
Yeah.
I'm saying if you're a person who likes the trailers, the people who just keep watching, and yeah, you see them afterwards, you know that's an important point. But, you know, so I haven't seen it in weeks. But I thought I just remembered it was a creepy and effective trailer. And, yeah, the shadow puppet stuff is great. I think they do a really, really good job with that. I think it's the rest that the Candyman stuff itself that just didn't work for me.
I love the use of mirrors in it.
The use of mirrors were great.
Well,
especially in the elevator.
Yeah, the elevator was pretty cool. Phil mentioned the score, and I gotta agree. I was fascinated by the music for this movie in the opening credits, actually, because there was this really kind of weird off music playing while this camera kind of floated through Chicago, pointed up at the sky.
Yeah, the upside downness was awesome.
And I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like that before, and I found it pretty entrancing.
It was awesome. It was really good. I think this could be the best score of the year I've heard so far.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
And they do have, not to keep going original. That is a thing. I mean, you have the Philip Glass score in the original, right? That you do kind of have to keep to that tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's fair. Eric's favorite composer, Philip Glass.
Fuck you. I don't mind his score for Candyman. I don't, but he's done some other stuff. I'm just like, oh, buddy.
Yeah. No, Candyman.
We are now going to... Here's my latest composition, Eminem's Hitting a Floor.
Right. At least it was better than A Little Joe. You know that one? Oh my god, that was crazy.
Oh man. He also, have any of you seen Koyaanisqatsi?
No.
Oh, good
Lord. I can't even pronounce it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I dare you to sit through that.
Can't even figure out how that's spelled from how you said it.
I don't even know.
I can go insane watching that movie, I guarantee it.
Oh, I can believe it, yeah. All right, so for folks who are new to the podcast, who we are and whatnot, basically what goes on is we don't just review films. We critique and dissect the film. So we talk about spoilers and symbolisms and what the director or screenwriter is trying to mean, specific acting things, whatever, whatever we want to talk about. But we do that after we throw out the spoiler alert. So we'll be throwing that out shortly. But before we do get into the spoiler alert, I guess we can talk about just general things about this movie or Candyman or any of that stuff. So let's talk about Tony Todd. Does anybody know why they decided not to go with Tony Todd?
He's not young.
Well, that's probably it. But, yeah, but I did read a quote from him as like originally he thought he might be involved with the movie. And when they decided to go a different direction, he wasn't like all mad about it. He was just like, they just decided to go somewhere else and that's fine. So it's not like he was crying about it in the corner.
I kind of like how they did it and how they added him in.
No, I mean, there are, oh yeah, there are, yeah, and again, not spoiling it. There's an aspect of the Candyman mythos from the first film that opens the door to this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In a couple of ways, in one metaphorically and two very literally. So that's there. I mean, the only thing is that, I mean, what Tony Todd has is he's got a voice that can't be beat.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. And that's really, really hard to escape. The alternatives in this case work well enough. Yeah, it's, you know, we're getting into the spoiler thing, but I mean, I think the reality is they know what they wanted, and what they wanted was to restart the franchise. And if they're restarting the franchise to go for any length of time, they're probably not going to get the guy who, you know, is getting older and is not necessarily going to have as much appeal to a younger audience and may not stick with the franchise for the next 10 and 15 years.
Well, and so, what I found interesting is that I have never actually seen any of the original Candyman sequels, and apparently that's fine because this movie ignores them.
Yes. Neither have I, and I've never heard anyone suggest a reason why I should.
Exactly. That's why I never got around to it. But however, I had heard this movie described as a quote spiritual sequel, end quote, to the original 1992 Candyman. So I wasn't really sure what to expect having heard that, and I was pleasantly surprised that they directly tied it to the first movie as much as they did, because having heard the spiritual sequel quote, I wasn't sure they were going to.
I'll go so far as to say there's nothing spiritual about this, that it is a straightforward sequel to the original.
Yes,
it is. It is a sequel that is set 30 years later.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you have to keep that in mind, you know, that this isn't, you know, the next day. But it is definitely a sequel in so many ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's totally affected by the original.
Yeah, well, and I didn't understand that until one of the opening scenes of the movie. And really, they did something which was effective on me, at least, which is that somebody in one of the beginning scenes of the movie starts telling the story of what happened in the first movie. And I'm hearing them tell this story, and I'm thinking to myself, wait, that's not what happened.
I love
then
that.
And then I'm thinking, I calm myself down. I'm like, wait, this person is telling the story as it would have been reported in the newspaper.
Right.
And that's pretty awesome.
But that's also
why myths are made, right?
Exactly. Yep. And that's one of the points, right, of the first movie, because the whole idea was to incorporate that story into the Candyman story. Mm-hmm. Right, she becomes part of it. The myth is malleable, mm-hmm. right? And I mean, I'm trying to remember. I don't know that she did any. I mean, did she do historical research on the first Candyman, or was it just spoken urban legend?
I believe our artist character in this movie does some research.
No, I understand. Yeah, he does. But that's actually was the thing I was wondering about.
Or are you talking about Helen from the first movie?
Helen from the first film. Did she do research on Daniel? Or
she did.
Okay.
Yeah. It was different research, but yeah. Like she was interviewing people.
Right. So that was oral tradition as opposed to mm-hmm. Because this was again something I was thinking about early in the film I was wondering, well, if this is an oral tradition as opposed to a factual historical act, which of course the two things are not inseparable.
Mm-hmm.
Then, yeah, the story of Candyman could change over time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that makes the myth malleable and updatable. And we know from the first film that the myth is malleable.
Because she becomes part of it.
Because she becomes part of it. That is the fucking point of the movie. all you fucking idiot Candyman fans. God.
Well, and after we get past spoilers, we can go into a little more detail about it. But I also like the way they exemplified that in this movie at one point, where our what's his name, Daniel Robitaille, the one they talk about in the first movie, wasn't the last.
Yeah. What I like, one of the imageries I like in this movie is the location in this revamped city. It's like a dead tooth in the middle of a bunch of white teeth, you know?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I just love that. It looks just awesome as they pan back and you see the whole city around it.
Well, and that's clearly one of the things that the makers of the movie wanted to highlight.
Yeah.
Was the gentrification of what used to be Cabrini Green.
Right, exactly. Now, I want to bring one other thing up about Tony Todd, too. I'm also thinking they didn't ask him to be part of the film. No disrespect to him or his acting ability or any of that. But similar to the guy that played Bishop in Alien and various other actors, they get tagged as, you know, those two-minute cameo roles that mean the movie's a B-film and whatnot, and if they started fresh using either unknowns or different actors, the movie may have been able to, I guess, get away from that when critics reviewed it, so to speak. But that's just a guess. I don't know if anybody has any thoughts on. I know, Mike, we've always discussed, you know, the actors that appear at conventions. You know,
look, he's a name to fans. He is nobody to anyone outside the convention circuit. You know, he's not putting any. No, I mean he's a good actor. I've seen him do good stuff. And again, his voice is unparalleled, right? There's very few who can have that voice. I have a lot of affection for him as an actor. I would have perfectly been fine to see more of him in this film, but I was expecting to not see him in this film. Because I remember when this was started, and they said Tony Todd is involved in the film. And everyone said, oh no, they got him back as Candyman. So they never said they brought him back as Candyman. All they ever said was that he has a role in the film. That means he could be the guy slinging peanuts from the vendor stand in the corner, right? As a cameo, as a nod, the same way you had Bill Murray had a role in the Ghostbusters reboot. You know, he wasn't coming back as Peter Venkman. He was just, what they did is basically kind of that sort of nod. It's like saying that Bruce Campbell had a role in the Evil Dead remake. Yeah, he kind of did. He was on screen for half a second.
Yep.
So I think, you know, they are trying to relaunch it. And I've always said, if you want your characters to sustain, if you believe that Candyman or Freddy, you know, or whomever is or Chucky, thinking of these characters, or Pinhead, you know, deserve to be ranked up there with figures like Dracula and Frankenstein? Well, then you're going to have to let them recast them, because that's the only way they're making movies about these characters in 70 years. Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Boris Karloff lasted for two Frankensteins, and Bela Lugosi did Dracula, what, twice? One, which was Abbott and Costello Meet Dracula?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, yeah.
You know, it's okay to recast it. I understand it's disheartening to think that Robert Englund might not be playing Freddy Krueger again, A, because we all like him, and B, because it's a reminder that we're all fucking old and going to die soon.
True, yeah.
We have to move on. Let younger generations have their thing.
Unless it's Indiana Jones.
Don't even get me started.
Hey, look. If we can recast Bond, we can recast Indy.
Yep, that's a fair point, Mike. Yep. Or maybe Hollywood should just start making original things.
What?
No, that can't happen.
Well, know when they
crazy.
No, well, first of all, they do make plenty of original things, but let's also remember the reason why they don't make original things is because people pay them to not make original things. When people stop paying to see remakes, sequels, rehashes, whatever, they'll stop making them.
Yeah, not going to happen, unfortunately.
Yeah, unfortunately. All right, so let's see. Anything else that anybody want to bring up before we get into plot details? I guess not. All right, so we will throw out the spoiler and talk about anything and everything about this movie. So if you have not seen this film, you have been warned.
Can we start with the elephant in the room, which is again another stupid criticism that Candyman went woke? It's like, have you ever watched Candyman?
Exactly. It's like, if you saw the 1992 Candyman, what were you expecting?
Yeah, it was woke before woke.
It's not like it strayed all that far from
Oh, God, no. If anything, I mean, I think we talked about in the podcast, right? This was a story steeped in the film version, not necessarily the book, steeped in African-American experience in America. That is what it was about, or at least the negative experience. What were they expecting?
Well, and that's the thing. We got to put it in perspective. I know people like to, in the news especially, just group everybody of one diversity or whatever as the same. I did a review on that movie Lucky on Shudder. I wrote a review up, and they're talking about this one. It's basically a woman who writes self-help books for women. And I wrote in her audience of like four people who were there to see her read her book at the bookstore, I said the only thing that any of the four women had in common that were watching her were basically that they had two X chromosomes, and that's it. So you can't just group an entire group of people and say this is the black experience or this is the whatever. So I've never liked how people do that, but I will say that this is at least framed in a way that this writer and director decided to make the film. And I think that's more fair than just saying this is the black experience, because you cannot just say all black folk had this experience. I mean,
but there are certainly, there are certainly things that apply to a large swath of the population that of different groups that do not necessarily apply to others. That means where the idea of a culture comes from. They deal with issues. It is what it is. Of course, there's individuality. No one's denying there's individuality. But even if things don't happen to you, when you have things that tend to fall on, for one good, bad, for whatever reason, one group or another, then even if it doesn't happen to that person in particular, they certainly know somebody who it happened to. They've heard the stories of who it happened to and all the rest. And that gets goes in informing that culture, too.
Well, and there's also the fact that there's a group of people out there, most of them racists, that just get all upset anytime a movie is made where it shows white people doing bad things to people of color. Because, it's just, woke mamby-pamby, and they shouldn't be showing stories like that. And it's just, if stuff like that didn't happen, they wouldn't tell the stories.
Well, this film's interesting because you have black people that are part of the gentrification.
Uh-huh.
So it's different take on the story, as far as I can tell, from the
film. Well, from that perspective, it is a little bit, but I liked how they kind of needed the Candyman mythos, like Plato.
Yeah.
And kind of turned it into, instead of, the Candyman being that dude, Daniel Robitaille, right, from the first movie, it's like a manifestation of all the unjust shit that has happened to black people in this area throughout the ages, right?
Yep, yep.
And I found that pretty interesting.
Yeah, it was. I think they did a lot of role reversals, and they, worked with that mythos really well.
Well, now see, this is where it's going to be. Yes, that is certainly, obviously, part of the Candyman story. It's kind of where they went with it. I think that they lost me a little bit in that. Again, Candyman was a, and again, this is the problem. It is when you, and I go both. And it's hard to. I want to have my cake and eat it too. Yes, you have to judge the work on its own. On the other hand, you're making a sequel with a particular character, so you're kind of trying to appeal to that audience too. But I think this kind of missed what the Candyman character was, because they kind of turn him into an anti-hero. And this vengeful spirit of the black community, which is not really what he was in the first film. He was a terror inflicted upon the black community himself, which was always a little bit of a weird thing.
Now I mention it, yeah.
But he was
isn't he, stop and isn't about he it still that way, a terror? Isn't he still a terror? I mean,
he's a savior at the end.
Yeah, yeah. Because if you notice this film, Barrett, he wasn't really a terror to, I guess, the community that, I guess, these candy men, since there's multiple of them, come from. He was a villain to, teenage girls in a bathroom, or a white folks yeah. at an art studio, or cops, corrupt cops. So he was not really the same monster
yeah,
that
we right.
saw in the first film.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a right. reinvention.
He wasn't really... Well, I mean, in the first one, he was a vengeful kind of.
Well, it's kind of two things, right? Because
one,
if you summon him in a mirror, he'll fuck you up. That's just that, right? It doesn't matter who you are. But then towards the end of the movie, he gets reintroduced as kind of a instrument of vengeance.
Right. Well, and that's the thing problem with films nowadays, because a couple of years ago when we had the Star Trek film and a couple others, it was showing empathy, a lot of those films. So there was a really big, what's Own a Zoo, the Matt Damon film or whatever it was called. There's a lot of empathy where people are good and all that. And now everything and to, anything, you can just name anything. And all it is vengeance. Everything is hate and vengeance now. It is no empathy or compassion or hope in anything. I mean, if it's going to be a nihilistic film or a TV show, that's fine, specifically because that's the topic. But now directors and screenwriters, no matter what their background is hate and vengeance and stuff. So it just feels weird.
That's a product of our society now. Nihilism is kind of rampant.
Well, you can do it that. I mean, like, you look at The Hunt, there was one character that you have empathy for in that film, generally.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the rest of them are idiots or evil bastards. But you still had that character. You certainly should have empathy, I think, for the central pair in this film. Yeah. And actually, their friends, the gay couple.
Yeah, that's was it? You mean the brother?
The brother with the I think they're kind of empathetic. I think they split them up a bit too much. I think there's too much of the film where they're just never in anything resembling a sense of jeopardy. This is a story in. Like here's, I guess, where you get my problem. And I understand this would start walking too close to the beats of the first film, but they're the ones who chose to tell this specific story. You have a black man in the house of a well-known white art critic, or the apartment of a well-known white art critic.
Right.
Two people who are art critics, two art people had died the night before in the gallery that is exhibiting his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
In front of his stuff that he had had a bit of a confrontation with at a party.
Right.
The art critic, he walks out of the apartment. The art critic turns up dead moments later. The theme of the film is police brutality towards innocent black men,
mm-hmm.
or innocent black people. He is never really a person of interest. You never get the sense that he's really like being hunted, being investigated. He's on the run. There's no sense of fearness or paranoia. Yeah, he does end up getting shot by a cop in the end, which is a part of a manipulation. We get the sense. But even then, the cops themselves, I'm not saying we should have well-drawn, deep, and empathetic portrayals of racist cops. But they are almost entirely off-screen in this film.
Yeah, they're not characters.
They're barely even caricatures.
Well, and right, because even the end, it wasn't – if he had just been standing there and they were racist cops and boom away – versus him already wounded and laying unconscious in his wife's arms, and then they blow him away, made it kind of be pulled out of the film. Because if they wanted to portray evil cops or racist cops, whatever you want to call them, it would have been better if it was legitimate instead of just cold-blooded murder. I'm not saying that doesn't happen.
Right. We have seen –
Go on, Mike. Yeah.
Right, it's literally, we don't see anything happen, and we just have to say, all right, take your word for it, the cop showed up and they shot the guy in cold blood, and he didn't deserve to be. Thank you.
Right. Well, and it wasn't even him standing up or them, being dinks about it. I mean, they just saw a guy in the arms of some woman, basically on death's bed, and they decided to just pull out the gun and blow his brains out. And it was like, what? I didn't get that.
Right, and we have seen movies like this, where like someone swats somebody or does something to get the cops to kill the wrong person, and there's tension, there's built, there's drama that goes to it. You get the rhythm of the moment. They insert you in the moment, and they don't do it here. And I could hear someone saying that, well, this is a film for a black audience, they don't need to see another black person being shot by the cops. Well, then don't tell this story.
Right.
You're the one that chose to tell this story.
Or show it better. Like,
or show it better. You don't have to actually show him on the screen, but you have to show, to me, you have to show more of it.
Or make it make more sense, right? Because the cops blowing him away while he's clearly incapacitated doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I mean, even for racist cops, it's just like, he's already down. So, I mean, it would have made more sense to me if, when the cops arrive on the scene, he was up and walking and got this hook sticking out of his hand. And, maybe he's trying to reach out to his girlfriend, and that's when the cops blow him away. That would have made much more sense,
right,
to me personally.
Exactly.
Right. And there are ways to do that that plays into the whole thing. That for me, this is why it's telling the story. So I guess what I was trying to say, when it's trying to say a thing, it knows it has people on its side, and everyone that it's making the film for kind of agrees with it, so it doesn't feel like it did the work. That it just said, well, the cops are just going to shoot the black guy anyway when he shows up, right? you know, that's what happened. And we go, oh, okay. And to me, so that didn't have the emotion it should have.
I get you. It was predictable and not entirely original. But
it was framed intentionally. Story,
right?
I don't even know if it was sloppy. Was it just framed to be silly? I don't know.
I don't know. I think it was to me. It felt like it was kind of done in shorthand. And it didn't work. Again, there's a lot of other things in the film to like, but you know, it's to me that's where it was missing is the thing that it was trying to do. And there was another thing I was going to say, and I just lost it. Damn it.
That's all right.
I hate when that happens.
No, I think I take your point on that, though.
Oh, I was going to say the other thing is
that,
this.
I did enjoy that final scene where she summons him out of the rearview mirror. That was pretty cool.
Is I also lost a little bit, like, I had trouble with point of view as to whose story we're really telling in this film. Because we shift back and forth from one character to a next as they're trying to tell a mostly point of view story, but not really telling a point of view story.
Right, that's a fair point, because
it's Coleman Domingo, who's the kid in the beginning who plays with the shadow puppets, who then is an adult and guy running the laundromat. Mm-hmm. And then it turns out so he starts out as the thing for the background, that's fine, and then he becomes the supporting character, but then he kind of steps in. No, it's really his thing all along has been manipulating things to get what he wants. It's really his story, but then it's not really his story. It just, you know, is it her story, is it his, because she's a sideline character for a large chunk of the film. And then who was the lead actor, not the lead actor, the lead character's name?
He played Anthony.
Anthony, right? He just feels like a very passive protagonist for a large portion of the film.
Yeah.
Well, and that also into the story, though. And this is, I said there was a part of the trailer I'm glad I didn't see. The part of the trailer I'm glad I didn't see is that they had Vanessa Williams in the trailer, who also played his mother in the first film. And if you'd seen that trailer, you might have had that in your brain and been able to put that together before you're meant to put it together. Because I really personally loved the reveal that he was that baby from the first movie.
Yeah.
I was like, whoa,
yeah,
fuck, me too. That's cool.
Now, I want to go back to what Eric said about, even though this kind of takes away from what we were just talking about, but Eric mentioned how I liked how she used the rear view mirror to call Candyman. Mm-hmm. But I still don't understand how the rules change. Because the rule, when you call Candyman, you are the one that's supposed to be in trouble along with the people around you. But it pissed me off that it's like, hold it, she's not getting killed too?
I wouldn't say pissed me off. I was confused, though, because you're right. That is a different rule. I think that something was supposed – I think maybe there were too many edits on the script. Because it seems to me like the character who runs the laundromat, right, was invested in trying to manifest Candyman as an instrument of vengeance, and that something he was doing was going to make that happen by getting Anthony involved. But that was not clear. That was not told well, if that's what was going on. And you're right, the rules changed. So I take your point on that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It just was weird, because why would he randomly kill five girls in a high school bathroom and then become a vengeful? Yeah, but also the woman in the Anthony's wife summoned him too, and she doesn't get killed.
That was the Candyman before. Yeah, he's the Candyman now, and so the mythology is changing as different people become.
Right.
But then it's Tony Todd 5 minutes later, so who the fuck knows?
Right,
right,
exactly.
No, I understand your confusion on that point.
Right, the Tony Todd thing makes me feel like, oh shit, the fans are going to be pissed if we don't squeeze Tony in here somewhere.
Right.
Well, what do we do? What if we superimpose his face at the very end? That doesn't make any sense. But yeah, it'll make fans happy.
Yeah, I mean, they could have used him anywhere, you know, any of the flashbacks or any of the mirrors, and they decided to use them at the end where he transforms, and it's like, I don't know.
I gotta say, though, the theater I went to see this has a really kicking sound system, and just Tony Todd's voice at the end saying, "Tell everyone." I was like, oh, fuck, that's awesome.
Yeah, he's got the bass going. He's got the bass going.
Yeah, he's got that infrasound, like the low,
the bass,
long wavelength that you just nobody can hear. Oh, God.
While I intellectually understand that it didn't make a whole lot of sense, I still really enjoyed the moment when it happened in the theater.
Yeah. No, that's fair. That's fair.
There is, but like to Barrett, like you were talking about the mirrors, right?
Hmm.
I think there's a lot of great mirror work. I think that's one of the things that's nice about Candyman as a character, even if they've only had, you know, previous to this, one good movie to his name, is that there's a lot to work with in his story, because you have the theme of the mirrors, you have the bees, you have the hook. You obviously have race as an issue, but it's not just like, he's not like a one trick pony. He's got lots of things they can bring in visually.
Right. And then they made in this one here, multiple Candymans now. Not just one.
Yep.
Or were there always more than one Candyman?
Well, in the first one, you've got Helen at the end, so you've got...
That's true. Well, and that's true. You also had the pimp, right? Or the drug dealer, whatever he was.
Yeah.
Who was taking on the Candyman mantle.
Yeah, but he was just using it to scare people because he was a drug dealer. But he wasn't a ghost like the rest of them.
Well, not to start. You get a legend built around him too.
Where it goes to start, that's a fair point.
And then the idea is they become legends, right? And it's they become part of the Candyman mythos. I think it's a little weird that they all end up with a hook on their hand. That's a little bit specific.
I don't think Helen did, though, did she?
No, I don't think she did. But she was,
not, yeah.
No, but she just ended up as his bitch. So
yeah.
Right.
But of course, that was also part of the myth, right? Was that for Candyman, the first one, as they mentioned in this one, is that it's the white woman is part of his story from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
But I do like the fact that they incorporate the first film fully into this, that you have Helen back. Scratch that. They bring Helen back as a voiceover, but it was a new recording.
Yeah.
So she recorded that for them. So I'm glad that her voice didn't change a whole lot. Or if they tweaked it, I don't know. They obviously brought Vanessa Williams back. They brought the baby back. And while they don't acknowledge the original Candyman for like maybe the first 45 minutes or so of the film, you know, they do like pay patient. They do come back around to it.
Right. Yeah.
You know, just be patient. Watch the movie, not the IMDb page.
Yeah.
Well, and I will say that through the course of the movie, I actually really enjoyed the art that Anthony was making. That was
depicting
again.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. His wife freaked out, that's for sure.
Well,
in the mirror with the place behind it, with the three-dimensional art that he made for the art place was really cool.
If I came home and my significant other was painting those things, I might freak out as well.
Well,
he was hiding it. If he just said that I'm making these weird paintings because I want to do this, I guess it wouldn't be a big deal. But then when she sees them and says, "What the hell?" and then he tries to hide them after that, it's like, okay, he has behavioral health issues probably.
Or he's being haunted by Candyman.
Right, but she doesn't believe in Candyman, so she thinks he's mentally...
Gracias a Dios.
Yeah, all the black people in this don't ever say it fully. It's the white people that do, and that's why they get killed.
they don't just say black people don't mess with that. They don't... Yeah. We don't
black people don't need to be summoning shit.
Yeah,
that was it.
Yeah, that's right. That's what he said. Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right.
That's part of it.
Yeah. Now, who's the guy that said, "I'm going to fly," and he jumps out the window? I didn't get that.
That was her father.
That was her father.
Who's her father?
From her past.
Brianna.
Yeah.
The wife.
Girlfriend.
Oh, okay. Oh, his his wife slash girlfriend. That was her father. Gotcha.
Which now, as far as I could tell, one of three things happened there. Either one, I missed hints of that earlier in the film. Two, this was a larger story point that was hit the editing room for. Or three, they just really threw that in there and didn't develop it at all. And I don't know which of those three it is.
It was hinted at earlier when they're talking about the fact that he isn't calling his mom back. And she's like, you should call her and enjoy the time you have to spend with her. Not everybody has that. So they
that's a really oblique
hint
because...
Yeah.
I mean, I get it. It just...
Yeah, it's almost like it was added because it was just a cool way to do it. You know, it was like, oh my, that's an awesome scene. Because it was an awesome scene. It's like, holy shit, the guy just fucking... But yeah, you're right. I mean, it doesn't really fit with that statement of, oh, you know, we don't all have... You know, but...
Or at least it's not specific enough. It's not the kind of thing where I get the sense... You know, we've all had someone die on us. We don't all have someone die on us because when I was like 12 years old, I watched them jump out a window saying they could fly.
Right.
You know, one is going to lead to a much different kind of trauma than the other.
Right.
Absolutely. And if that was supposed to be a thing that was fueling her character, I missed it.
Okay.
I think
it would have been really lame if we got in a forced exposition scene about that.
Right, and that's so I'm saying there might have been stuff in there that I missed that will be more apparent on a rewatch. That is one of the possibilities.
Right.
Also possible there was more there that hit the editing room floor. Maybe stuff that was really shitty and overhanded and heavy-handed. Maybe that got hit the editing room floor.
Yeah,
I have no idea.
I don't know. I'm just guessing that it was there because it was a kind of freaky scene. Because otherwise they could have just had her say, you know, you remember what I told you about my father, how he died in a car accident or he got killed in the war.
Well, and I'm not 100% sure I want to I want to buy this on disc when it comes out. And I hope it has a bunch of features because I want to know everything about what the people who made this movie were thinking.
Yep.
It might have been her dad might have also been painting the Candyman. There was a painting propped up against the desk when she walked up against them, but I couldn't quite make it out and see what it was.
Well, you know what?
That would be interesting.
That would be interesting. Unfortunately, as Mike said, maybe it landed on a cutting room floor and they didn't emphasize it enough because she could have said something about, yeah, we all, you know about when the brother says, no one's going to cancel, you know, call the Candyman. Hell no. And they could have said, yeah, I mean, our father had, you know, he was all screwed up because of that. But they didn't do that. Mm-hmm. You know, if they
right.
Something like
no, I'm just saying. I saw. I. There was a painting propped up against the desk. It was kind of fucked up, kind of like the stuff that Anthony was painting. But I couldn't quite tell if it was supposed to be the Candyman.
Gotcha. Yeah. It is interesting. So, if for rewatch value, that may be something interesting to check out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's see. Where else do we want to go? What else do we want to bring up? I think the best scene was some of the mirror scenes. The one where was it the elevator where he's looking at his reflection? And it's the Candyman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That happened in the
art critic's house.
Yeah, that was the main one.
Yep.
Yeah, that's the one I liked. That was pretty solid.
I liked the elevator because you saw him going on into infinity in the distance. It was just really cool, and then he looks up and he sees the Candyman up above him.
It was also funny when the doors opened.
Yes, and he's all scared.
You know, people standing there are just like, dude, what's your deal?
Yeah. What else? What else we want to talk about?
I'm thinking.
Yeah, there's gonna be more. We gotta talk more. Right? Yeah. What do you guys think of that woman critic? What was up with that?
Oh, she was a twat. I'm glad she died.
Yeah, I was too.
Did she actually die?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, she did. Didn't you see it?
The husband was a suspect. They even talk about it.
It was a long shot. I'll give you that. But
yeah.
It was from the outside of the building.
She's held up in the air.
You see her head get smashed up against the window and then little bloody trails that gets pulled to the side.
Yeah, you really had to look in there, though, because it was like, from this, on a huge screen, it was like a tiny little gnat.
Yeah, it was pretty small in comparison, but they did show it.
Right.
Yeah, I was glad she died.
She was just being manipulated by an invisible force. Presumably the candidate.
Right.
But wouldn't that be fucked up if it was Casper?
Yeah, indeed. Casper. But I guess her character, yeah, I mean, that is just a typical, right, you know, I mean, we saw that in that Jake Gyllenhaal film a year or two ago.
Oh, the Buzzsaw?
Yeah, that one, where those critics are just pompous, whatever, and yeah, so she was
kind of... Well, that's typical, because she was being a total bitch to him at his display, right, in the museum, and then once he gets all buzzy because of his name being in the news because of the murders, and she's like, oh yeah, come over for an interview.
Right, right.
Fuck off. I'm glad
you're... Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, she's just part of the artistic industrial complex, whatever you want to call it, where she's just using everybody and anybody and whatever. Sociopath, probably. All that good stuff. Yeah. But was there any white folk that were considered good? I mean, the boyfriend, right? He was
all
right.
Yeah, he was good.
Yeah.
He was, I don't know why, but I kept on trying to make him in my head Jack Black.
Yeah.
Me too. I can see that way. Yeah.
I can see that. Yeah, I can see that. For sure.
Oh, one thing about the art critic I forgot to mention, I thought she was going to die in the bathroom for sure, so the way it happened was a surprise for me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is one of the better deaths in the film.
Yeah.
I think it's also one of the only ones that really, right, that really does happen on screen.
First two, don't you count as on screen?
What?
The girl in the bathroom, kind of, sort of, but not really.
Right, the girl in the bathroom, much more not really. That was more, see the blood spatter?
The girl in the very beginning that gets cut across the throat, that happens on screen.
Right.
Mm. Yeah, no, the violence was R-rated. There was enough R-rated violence, yeah. But I mean, it wasn't, you know, anything extreme for R rated, but it was enough that it would get an R, that's for sure.
I was actually surprised it was R, because it felt a little tame for me.
Well,
compared to some things I see that are R.
Well, you know what it is that you had the throat slits and stuff like that. That was enough.
Yeah.
To make it an R, you know. Yeah.
Well, two F-bombs is enough to make it an R, so...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, The Conjuring, the first one, didn't have F-bombs or violence, but intense scenes made it an R, believe it or not.
The MPAA is stupid.
Yeah, that's so weird.
Yeah,
you would have thought that documentary that came out a couple of years ago, more than like 10 years ago, was it This Movie's Not Yet Been Rated, or whatever it was called,
mm-hmm.
That really like kind of lifted the curtain. Mm-hmm. On how that works. You'd think that would have embarrassed them into stuff like standards.
Consistency.
And instead, they just seem to come out and just say, nope, we're going to lean into it even harder now.
Yeah.
Yeah, my favorite story from that documentary was the guys that make South Park talking about how every time the MPAA told them something was too bad, they just make it worse. And eventually they were like, forget it, here's your arc, get out.
Or how they would put things in specifically to get cut so the other stuff that was in it wouldn't look as bad.
Well, that's also true, yeah.
We're gonna have a puppet shitting on another puppet. And then... So with the cunnilingus scene, whatever gets to stay in. Yeah. And then it's like... And then of course, they're like, you know, we kind of want to leave the shitting scene in there.
Well, at least this film didn't have shit all over the walls and stuff. That was like gross.
Well, that's to me part of the creepiness.
Still bothered by that.
Yeah.
One thing in this movie I did. Oh, like, it was probably the most disturbing part of the movie to me, is that he got that bee sting on his hand that just kept on festering.
Right.
And then they started messing with it, and I'm just like, dude, don't fucking touch it. What are you doing?
Hospital, now.
Yeah, I think that's also part of it, that it wasn't, because it went from bee sting to Egyptian curse, like, really quick.
Yeah, pretty quick.
Yeah. And I would have liked, either they should have toned the makeup down and built it up a little more, so it just, like, maybe got, like, you know, blistery, at least at first.
Right.
Or maybe it would have been nice if they had the wife notice a little bit more.
Yeah.
Right. You know, because, again, I think it helps to have that relationship. Which, and this is not a relationship like in the first film, where the two of them are where he's fucking around behind her back, so it's okay that there's a little bit of estrangement going on. Because then that would have helped tie, I think, that they felt like they broke them up, kind of, like she's breaking, but they don't, because he's gone nuts, but he didn't exactly, like, attack her. He broke mirrors.
I'm right.
Yeah. And he's clearly not right in the head, and she's like, oh, that's it, I'm done. It's like, but there's never been any hint of there being a problem in the relationship, really, besides, I mean, other people are saying things like, you know, like he's just, you know, a layabout artist, he should get a real job, maybe.
Yeah.
But there's artist no true. Real hint within their relationship, within them, that says there's anything wrong, where it's like, okay, this is the last straw.
I agree.
So even that relationship felt a little like it could have been fleshed out better, especially to get it where they needed to have the catharsis, not the catharsis, the tragedy at the end of the film.
I just want to ask about this. It's inconsequential, so it's not really important, but a couple of you have referred to her as a wife.
She's girlfriend. Yeah.
Girlfriend.
Just living together.
Girlfriend. Married. Sorry. Okay.
Yeah. But I still think she would have gotten help for him.
You thought they were married, that's all.
Yeah, I think she would have gotten help for him rather than immediately leave. She might have left, but still gotten help for him. That I would have seen more. But doing nothing?
Oh, yeah, hey, your neck looks like a beehive.
And you're breaking mirrors and doing violence.
Are you using a new aftershave? Is that...
Yeah, you're getting, like, leprosy. you got burnt in a fire, but I'm going to just not worry about it. That would be it.
And I'm suddenly not going to worry about appearance.
Stuff happened after she had already left.
Yeah, that's fair. But when she did see him...
And this is probably why I got there already. How about that scene at the end of the movie when she just stabs the shit out of that laundromat guy? I didn't see that coming. That was pretty intense.
Yeah, I was surprised too. I was too. It didn't seem like she would have been that way, but also the intensity of hatred and, like, insanity.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when she went to stab him, I was like, oh, okay. And then she just kept going. I was like, whoa. He's
dead now.
I didn't think you can stop that. Holy shit.
Definitely dead.
Well, I mean, if you're going to do it,
follow through, right?
Make sure they're dead, right, in horror movies, and she made sure he was fucking dead.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Somebody listened to Jesse Eisenberg in Zombieland and double-tapped, triple-tapped, quadruple-tapped.
Yeah, hey, like I always say, when they fall down, you make sure they never get up again. I've seen enough of horror films. Yeah, I've seen enough horror films. You never let them get up. So I'll give this film that credit, is that they didn't do the stupid trope where, run away!
He stabbed the ever-loving shit out of that guy.
Yeah, she did it right. You make sure he never gets up again if he's the guy that's going to be possibly killing you.
Although, well, he already kidnapped her, so...
Yep.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that was enough right there. Yeah, he's done. You got to make sure he never gets up again. Absolutely. Yeah.
Although now I do also want to point out, Coleman Domingo is a regular on Fear the Walking Dead.
Yep.
He is not Tony Todd, but he also has a pretty smooth voice.
He does.
A baritone.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, also another reason why she had a right to take the thing to the guy was because she saw him chop off the hand.
Yes.
Shove it.
Not in one swipe either. It was several swipes.
I was saying the ferocity of it surprised me.
Well, yeah. If you're going to take someone's hand, is a hacksaw your first choice? How are you doing?
More disgusting ones.
I mean, I would have thought maybe meat cleaver. I don't know.
Axe.
Yeah. What was it in Saw? Right.
Buzzsaw.
A saw in the movie Saw. It was a saw. Right.
Yeah, I know it was a saw. But maybe it was just a big fist. Maybe he's a Saw fan. Who knows? then it would have been the foot, but then Candyman would look really weird with walking around on.
How about limping?
Well, he could have had a Captain Ahab foot
peg leg.
Yeah,
there you go. And then like in the sequel, Candyman come back and he's killing people with the peg leg. And
I'd kind of like to see that.
That's awesome. Death Proof, the machine gun.
Yeah, there you go with the machine. There you go. See, I think Candyman. Okay. We need to send in our new improved version of Candyman with the machine gun peg leg instead of a hook hand.
Awesome. Oh my god, that would be the best Grindhouse film ever.
Oh my goodness.
Oh,
that's awesome.
Well, no, that's it. Right now, we get the black guy, his leg is shot off by the cops, and so, you know, he gets a leg machine gun and blows, and goes all, precinct, what was it, precinct?
13?
13, yeah, on the cops, oh.
That's awesome. Oh, jeez. Now, that would be good, because it would be a true Grindhouse film, so I have no problems with that ridiculousness and vengeance and all that crap.
Well, no, if you're going to do ridiculous, then lean into it. You know, lean into it completely.
Exactly. And that's what Quentin Tarantino can do. He does it the best, and he wins Oscars for it. It's awesome. God bless him. God bless him.
So in the end, I felt like I've never felt like the first film was the greatest film ever. I felt like this was a worthy successor, and again, not the greatest film ever, but I still enjoyed it. I still liked it.
No, it's a decent film.
Yeah.
And like I said, I'd give it a mile. I love the original Candyman because it is just to me a movie that hits my nerves, and you know, it just might be that I am not white. I am like skim milk white, you know, just like
when you said I am not white, I was like, where is he going?
I'm like, no,
I said not just white. I'm like, you know, like the whitest person you could possibly imagine under, and then add some extra lighting on top of that, and then lock me in a closet so I haven't seen the sun for a few years. That's like I'm like that white, and so maybe that's part of it, is the whole then throw you in like the blackest, ghettoest part of Chicago possible. It's not even New York City, which I would be fine with. It's Chicago, and where it was like an alien world where they have bizarre pizzas, and I don't understand that. I think that's part of it, and it's not like I could necessarily have identified with her any more or less than the lead here, but I think you know her being in an isolated alien element heightened it for me a lot better than, again, you did a guy wandering around well-lit apartment buildings.
Yeah. And to be honest, it had nothing to even do with her being white in a black community. It was her being a woman in a crime-ridden area, you know? I mean,
well, and
when I drive down the street and you see some woman jogging on a dirt road, I'm like, that woman's crazy, man. I would never want my daughters to be alone anywhere.
Not with you driving around, no.
Well, no. I think I've told this story before, but I was working late one night, and this woman down the hall from me says, hey, Phil, could you walk me to my car? And it's like 8 o'clock. I go, yeah. And I'm like, wait, why? And she goes, oh, because you just never know. I'm a woman. And I go, holy shit, that's a fucking good point.
Yeah.
You know? So that Helen was like I had courage.
yeah.
No, but absolutely, and
or stupidity,
and that too. The two often go hand in. But I do think, like, you know, the Vanessa Williams character might have reacted to her differently had she been, you know, a black woman coming to do the investigations.
Sure.
You know, I do think that her being white was a part of it.
Yeah, that's true.
I just think there were stuff they could have done with this film to make it feel more comfortable. Or even had flipped the script and had him being the artist from the ghetto, you know, or from the projects being brought up into this suburban environment where he doesn't feel like, not suburban environment, but this gentrified environment where he feels like he doesn't belong. But he doesn't even realize he was born in Cabrini Green, right? When you do go see Vanessa Williams, she has gotten her shit together. Good for her.
Mm-hmm.
She seems to be living in a decent place now. She's not the hysterical mom with the screaming baby anymore.
Oh man, I love that reveal though.
Yeah.
Oh shit.
Yeah. Yeah, that was
fun. Well, and I get your points, Phil and Mike. Like, I really like this movie, but it could have been an even better movie.
It could have been better. It could have used some more passes. But again, like, but I said, there's so much I like about this film. I like the performances in the film. I love a lot of the visuals in the film.
The music.
And the music is great. It's just that if I'm going to see a Candyman film, I want it to be a little bit more disturbing and then nice to look at. And I guess that's where a lot of it comes in. Yeah, there's some neat stuff. I love, like, there's a shot where stuff that, you know, again, where we can only do now really with CGI, where there's the bee that lands on the mirror and then kind of turns into its own reflection.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was cool.
And walks off the mirror. That was a really neat one. Little things like that are great. They do a lot of stuff early on. That's why, and I think that's why, like I said, I really like the beginning of the film. And to me, they just didn't really ramp up the tension in the end, and I was a little confused as to where they were going. I mean, I know where they were going, but how they kind of justified how the film ended and what they decided to do with the Candyman character, because to me, it doesn't quite fit who Candyman was before, which I know it's a new Candyman, but I've always had this thing where I hate when villains are turned into antiheroes, because, oh, people like him, so we must have him kill bad guys.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. And it's like,
but you were okay with that in Don't Breathe 2.
Not entirely. I mean, Don't Breathe 2. Well, here's the thing. Don't Breathe.
Well, they're both bad in Don't Breathe 2, right? Because you get he's a bad guy for what he's done, but
the
criminals are bad guys for breaking in. And the only thing, at least with that guy, yeah, so go on, Mike, I'll let you explain it.
No, they were definitely doing it in Don't Breathe 2. They realized they got this guy, and they just gloss over whatever happened, but they kind of bring it around at the end of the film.
Okay.
You know, they do bring it back. It's just that they spend most of the first film not addressing it, and it's not until you get to the end of the film where they still don't address what happens in the first movie. So I kind of rolled my eyes at that, but I was able to roll with it. And again, in the first film, it's questionable until the turkey baster is revealed. He's not really a villain either. And then you get the turkey baster. So I was, you know, they let it go, and there was always a mystery in that film. So I was willing to let that pay off. Here, the whole combination was to turn Candyman into the superhero who comes in and saves the day from the evil cops. And I was like, oh. But that's okay. Now he's going to get to go kill sorority girls who deserve to get what they get because they're fucking around with evil spirits they know nothing about.
Exactly.
Right.
And Phil can get boobs.
Yes.
So what was
the... Well, that's the whole point of the hook, you see, is that allows him to swipe at the girls and accidentally rip off their shirts.
So what is the point of Candyman then at the end of this film, then, as a vengeful anti-hero? I don't know
yeah.
where they're going.
Yeah, it's like they turned him into a protector of the community rather than a scourge of the community.
It's like Maleficent or something. It's like, what the hell?
Yeah, there's another one. Oh, God.
Yeah, so... Or Cruella de Vil is another one now they've done it too. It's like, what's going on here? What, the villains are villains. I mean, when Jason... Jason was still a villain, and Freddy were still villains in their later films. And of course, they were funny, and you wanted them to kill everybody, but they were still villains.
Yeah,
right.
So they were exactly. heroes because they're awesome creatures, but they're still villains. So why don't they just leave
them
villains?
Yeah, I mean, even Cruella de Vil, I'll say they just basically justified it by saying, by acknowledging that she was going bad, but just pitting her against someone who was even worse.
Yeah.
And it's and yeah, there's still a little bit of a redemption there, but at least they for some of the film they embraced her being evil, and they haven't necessarily gone, because I'm sure there's going to be a sequel because it made a shit ton of money. Who knows where they're going to go with it? But yeah, I mean, they didn't go like the full hero turn that they basically did with Maleficent, where she was just completely misunderstood.
Indeed.
Well, kind of like Harley Quinn too, right? I mean, Harley Quinn is now a kind of an anti-hero.
Yeah, she was another one. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, because she was awesome when she was basically the female Joker. I mean, that was awesome. But yeah, now she's kind of an anti-hero kind of thing.
Right, Venom was another one. Venom was the one that always sticks out in my mind, because he just became so popular so fast. They like completely walked back a lot of the character, just said he's kind of a hero, except he has a Spider-Man thing. It's like, that's
step
like,
away for a minute. Stupid. You guys are already talking comic book movies.
Yeah. we're just talking about how they like taking villains and turning them into anti-heroes as opposed to just letting them be villains.
Right.
And that kind of felt to me like what they did with Candyman.
Right. And that's what I still have no answer for. I go, what's the point?
Well, the point is that someone said, hey, look, for lack of a better term, woke black horror film made a shit ton of money and got an Oscar nomination, and I think won an Oscar. Do we have any other horror properties about, like would tie into themes about black people in America? And someone looked and said, there's this one from 1990, and they said, okay, make a movie out of that, but make it more in themed for today. What's a theme for today with the black community? They looked out the window and they said, there's people marching. I said, make it about that. And they did that. And
cynical.
And that's what it is, right? That was very much, because they did the same thing with Saw. Right, is that that's what they did with Spiral, the last Saw film, is it was Jigsaw is out to punish bad cops now. That's what that does. That's what we're doing. and you know, it's the one good cop, of course, is the black cop on the beat, but it's Chris Rock, because that's what I think of when I think of Chris Rock, is as a good cop. You know, and it's again, I'm not saying that the themes are not worth exploring and exploiting, and horror should certainly do that. I mean, they did it with, you know, nuclear weapons in the 50s, and we can go through environmental terror and all the rest of it. So it's certainly very, very ripe for picking. But to think that there's anything but a cynical cash grab on these things, I think is silly. I think everyone is rushing to make their social justice, whatever, horror film. Just Candyman did it 30 years ago.
Right.
So I don't know why the hell. Like, no, someone says, I don't get, like, someone wants to complain about Spiral turning Saw woke. Okay, fine, I get it. And even though that was a franchise that was a bit all over the place, and people often missed, I think, what it was trying to say at different points, including some of the filmmakers they brought in along the way. This was what Candyman has always been.
Yeah.
I don't understand it. I don't understand how could you claim to be a fan of, I mean, maybe all they ever saw were sequels, and I missed the sequels, and the sequels missed the point too. So maybe the sequels weren't.
Yeah, the sequels, you know. Candyman was white.
Yeah, it was white Candyman, and his girlfriend was.
Is that true?
No,
he's Tony Todd, right? Yeah,
no, that was.
I've seen them. I'm just making a joke.
Oh, gotcha.
I have seen them, but they were so not that great that they don't even leave a memory in my head.
Yeah.
Except very dimly.
Right.
Does anybody know if Tony Todd does audiobooks? Because I would love to listen to him read a book.
I actually have. He's actually done an audiobook.
For Anthony from
Harvard. For Anthony Mann. And I have actually downstairs. He was supposed to be at Scares the Care a couple of years ago.
I remember seeing that post.
And I have the vinyl pressing of Dracula by Tony Todd.
Nice.
That I was waiting for him to autograph that I was going to do as a giveaway at a Dracula talk that ended up not making it.
Yeah.
Right.
But I still have it, and I'm still, if I ever see him again, I am going to get him to autograph it.
Cool.
Right. Yeah.
And actually, I've never listened to it because, you know, it's vinyl and it's still 2021, although I know that in theory I'm supposed to.
Here's the thing. Now costs more than it did when
people. Yeah. Look, I understand the vinyl thing. I get it. I understand it. But this is like now people are releasing shit on cassette.
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah, I know. That's funny. But, yeah, because I'm so tempted to buy Taylor Swift's albums because she's selling them on vinyl. And it's like, do I really want them? What am I going to do with them except put them on the wall? So it's like, I'm going to skip it.
But their vinyl pressings have her own blood mixed into the formula. So you can now have some Taylor Swift DNA in your album.
Licking them.
Oh, for Christ's sake, that's right.
I'm going to have to watch the third Candyman because it says it was filmed in 99, but it takes place in 2020.
That's really interesting. That's
25 really years, interesting. And there's an art gallery event in the movie, too.
What?
No, you're not supposed to go into the future until the fourth entry of the franchise.
So maybe, you know what? You may be, well, yeah, you're right. Yeah, Resident Evil, I think, was the third.
So that would be the fourth film, Candyman film, would be when Candyman crosses over with Brother from Another Planet and they go into space.
Right. I'm sure you may be able to find it, Barrett, on like Tubi or
yeah, I'm gonna have to check around.
Yeah.
And the second one, I know, remember that one was the one where it takes place a lot of it in the past during the plantation stuff, where you get a lot of his history.
Yeah. I think I saw bits of one, and I was like, oh, that's not very good. I have a hazy recollection of that. I don't know if it was something I just saw scenes of. I know I didn't watch the entirety of one of the sequels. I'm pretty sure I saw at least clips from one of them, and I just was not impressed.
Let's see, anything else?
I think we're running out of steam here.
Yeah, I'm exhausted. Today's the first day of school. I am barely awake.
Indeed. All right, so before we get into our final thoughts on this film or even some house cleaning, anybody want to discuss anything they've seen that may interest folks that are listening to this podcast? What about you, Eric?
Genre stuff. This isn't really related to the podcast, but there is a documentary series that is coming out on Hulu right now by National Geographic in association with the there's a museum that collects all the information about 9/11. And so over the last 20 years, they've been compiling interviews and footage, and the 20th anniversary of that event is coming up. So I felt compelled to watch that, and it is harrowing shit because it's real. It's not a movie. But if you feel compelled to see what went down that day from a lot of it is point of view footage from people that were on the scene, check that out if you can handle it. But trigger warning, real live footage of people dying, it's not pleasant.
Yeah, I won't be watching that. I won't even be having my computer on or regular TV on in 9 days from now.
Yeah, I mean, I've long said that I don't think it was a big coincidence that the soft films became a thing after that.
Mm.
Because part of the appeal of the Saw films, and obviously different things appeal to different people, but it was one of the points of the Saw films is what would you do to stay alive, right? And, you know, you just had a thing where people were watching, you know, what would you do if, you know, what would you do if you're trapped on the top of a skyscraper that's burning and about to collapse?
Mm-hmm.
You know, would you, you know, and what would you do if you were on that plane and, you know, they were going to use it to fly into the White House or whatever they were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was certainly stuff that was percolating in the back of people's heads at that time. The idea that, now I'm not saying that that was necessarily the reason that was a success, but I could certainly see that thought percolating in the back of like the writers and inspiring them to do a story, even if whether they're consciously aware of it or not, all about the, what would you do to survive?
Well, and I just want to be clear I wanted to put that warning on it, but it's not just tragedy porn. There are also some incredible stories of survival and heroism. So yeah, you get the full impact of the tragedy, but you also get, you know, the interview with a guy who somehow walked out of the Hilton in front of the Twin Towers after they both collapsed. It's like, what? But, yeah. So
the thing that always,
most people have had enough, but if you care to view it as a tribute of some sort, it's there on Hulu.
The thing that always disturbs me on top of the actual events of the day is just the knowledge that if that plane had left an hour earlier, you would have had easily like 10 times as many casualties. There would have been 70,000 people in those buildings.
Mm.
Because they hit first thing in the morning. And mm-hmm. if the commuters had all gotten in, that would have been even, I mean, it was bad as it is. But then, you know, then the third thing that just disturbs me is the fact that there's 25-year-olds who like don't remember anything about it.
Well, next year there will be people old enough to drink that were not alive when that happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. And weirdly enough, they're already allowed to vote.
Mm-hmm.
yeah, no, I did that. You know, it was a weird, like not long after I started the mental countdown of my students of like, when am I getting the kids that don't remember 9/11, where I cannot have that as a common talking point
mm-hmm.
with them. And it doesn't take long because, you know, you got to realize most people aren't going to remember anything that happened when they were like below five and God willing, their parents weren't sitting down with them and going, all right, Joey, sit down and watch. This is going to be important for you to know for history. Look at the man jumping from right. the tower, Joey. Yeah.
I wonder, do they, Mike, you might know, do they mention it in history class in school?
I mean, I don't sit in. I mean, I know they mention it. Okay. I know they go over it. I know that some of the social studies teachers in my school have showed some of the videos. Class,
that wasn't history yet.
Hmm?
When I was in history class, that wasn't history yet.
No, that would have been prognostication. That would yeah, but no, that is. I mean, it's a thing, and you know, it is. And at least in this country, you know, certainly one of the for whatever you think of what happened after 9/11, you can't not look at 9/11 and realize how much that affected the course of this country, mm-hmm. and of course. Down to events that are happening and folding in the news right now. So yeah, they have to address it, you know. I don't know, like if they show the people jumping from the buildings, I don't know what they do with that. But I mean, the videos are out there. And it's the thing is, again, as old people, you know, it's easy for us to forget like that 25-year-old was like watching Ninja Turtles that day.
Yeah.
Anyway,
so, I didn't mean to take us totally off topic. I just thought
yeah, we're getting way off topic.
Okay, so
it's horrific. So
yeah,
I don't like talking about that.
People that listen to this podcast might have the fortitude to sit through it.
Fair enough. Very good. Anything else, Eric? You want to bring up?
That's it for today.
All right. What about you, Barrett? What do you got?
I don't really have anything that I can think of right now.
All right. Sounds good. What about you, Mike?
Pam and I did start watching a series. I don't know why we started watching it. it was just like we were looking for something to watch, and she saw that, and it seemed to appeal to her. And I can't actually remember the name of it at the moment, but it was on Shudder, And we only watched two episodes. It's only eight episodes. It's a Canadian show. So you know it's going to suck. No, it was okay so far. It was okay so far. I'm more curious to see the whole thing before I give any verdict. But it's basically about like a teenage indigenous boy in Canada, tribal person, whatever the terminology is we're supposed to be using now, and the idea of a trickster demon, or beings, shapeshifters, and we're only two episodes into it, but they really need to lean a little more heavily. It's got, you know, five skull rating on Shudder, but Shudder voters are very, very lenient.
What's it called?
Trickster.
Trickster. Okay.
So, I'm curious to see where it goes. I just wanted to mention that I've seen it. I also went to see the movie Protégé. If you're interested in something non-horror, more action-y, it's with
is that the one with Maggie Q?
Yep. Maggie Q, Samuel L. Jackson, and Michael Keaton.
I want to check that out, but I'm probably going to wait for VOD.
Is it worth seeing?
I liked it. I liked it quite a bit. It's got a little bit more depth than I expected it to.
Because I love Maggie Q. She's awesome.
Oh, Maggie. Yeah. They're all awesome. Everyone in the film is awesome. You know, Michael Keaton is awesome. So the idea is that Maggie Q is sort of the adopted protege, hence the title, of Sam Jackson. And they make a career of killing bad people for money, of getting the people that nobody else can get to. For money. You know, they're not doing it out of like some righteous sense of vengeance. They're doing it for money. And Michael
Keaton. It kind of sounds like Stephen King's latest book.
Oh, all right. And then a thing happens that, you know, with the latest person they're trying to hunt down, and Michael Keaton plays sort of his like the opposing muscle, the opposing hitman. And he and Maggie Q have like this weird dynamic and relationship that's kind of fun. But yeah, I enjoyed it. It's got some good action in it. Though it's not an all out action film either. It's not like John Wick. But it's certainly a decent film. I would recommend it.
Cool.
All right. Sounds good. Anything else, Mike?
I think that's it.
All right. Yeah, I got nothing. So I guess we can get into our final thoughts on this film. But before we do, Eric, you actually do another podcast with your buddy Dan?
I do. It is a general interest podcast called the Askancity Podcast. That's spelled Askancity. You can find it wherever you got this one.
What episode are you on right now?
I don't know. 460 something?
Yeah, so you got it up there too. Nice. Now, Barrett, me and you just released a episode for another podcast.
Halloween Boutique Psychotronic Reviews. We released an episode 30, in fact, about the movie Pig with Nicolas Cage.
Yep, that's right. That's right. It was a damn good movie. We discussed that a week or two ago. Eric said he liked it too, which is which is a good thing. And everybody should check out the podcast and most certainly check out that film. And Mike, me, you, and Eric are going to this month do an episode of another podcast.
Just like last month and the month before.
In theory, we're going to be we didn't actually do. We've talked about the film, but we have not actually reviewed it for the podcast. Because it came up in last week's episode on the hunt. So yes, we're going to be watching or discussing a classic 1997 thriller. We'll let you figure it out. It is one that Eric Webster has chosen for Cinema a la Carte, which is again the podcast that we use. That's a monthly-ish, bi-monthly-ish, tri-monthly-ish podcast when we can get to it. Life is what life is, and so we will be discussing that. So it's the podcast for movies that are not dark discussion movies. and it helps if they star Tom Cruise, but this one doesn't because all of Tom Cruise's movies are being pushed back even further again. I think Mission Impossible 7's been pushed back. Top Gun has been pushed back. He's never getting another movie ever again.
All right, sounds good. I guess we can get into our final thoughts on Candyman 2021. I know it's our view, Mike.
Yeah, like I said, so I thought it missed the market what it was trying to do. There's a lot of things that are admirable about it. And like I mentioned, the performance of the visuals, the music. It wasn't scary or tense, and it didn't even like feel like it was trying to be to me. And so I'm not really sure what happened. And I think they didn't flesh out the story of the bad cops like enough, because I think they were just taking it for granted that everybody would be on board with that story. And I think they really could have done a little bit more to drum up the pathos of that. But I would still like it enough of it that if you're at all interested or a fan, especially if you're a fan of Candyman, because this is definitely a sequel on multiple points, then I would still give it a mild recommend.
All right, sounds good. For me, pretty much what Mike said. I think if you're a fan of the franchise, just be aware that there is some changes. So don't, there's a chance that you'll just go, oh, I can't stand this film. They screwed up my favorite monster or whatever. But, it's still worth checking out because, it is part of the franchise. The film was well made. Generally, there's some issues with it, but the cinematography, the music, acting, all that's good. Especially the music. So I would recommend it, to check it out, but just keep your hopes and fears in check and all that other good stuff. Barrett.
Yeah, I really like this film. I thought it was a good successor to the original, and I love the cinematography and the visuals, and I thought the score was really good and the acting was really good. It's worth seeing.
All right. Eric?
I liked it more than Mike and Phil did. I understand everybody's points, but it didn't matter to me when I was watching the movie. I just really enjoyed the experience. I think it is very good filmmaking skill being displayed there, and I can deal with a little quirks as far as the plot goes. So I would recommend it.
All right, sounds good. So once again, this is a sequel. So now everybody now knows exactly that it's a sequel and not a remake of the original Candyman, directed by Nia DaCosta. We already discussed her incredible rise. And starring Yahya Abdul-Mateen, Tayona Paris, Nathan Stewart Jarrett, Coleman Domingo. Cinematography, John Gulasirian, and the music by Robert Lowe. Film is still at theaters. Not quite sure how long that will be because, it is COVID. But I'm sure it'll be readily available after. One thing I forgot to mention to Mike is, Mike, they had the MGM Lion. That was pretty cool.
Oh, not only that, I forgot about that. Did you notice that the MGM Lion
was backwards?
That whole beginning cool. part. Yeah.
Yep, yeah. Yep. Weirdly enough, though, they missed this, like the no smoking signs in the subway. In other words, like the signs, the lettering, it was too small to read, but the slash sign was the correct way. So I have a feeling what they did was, for a lot of these, is they just reversed the words and not the images.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, it was still a nice touch. It was a neat touch. I just have to spoil it.
Indeed. Once again, check it out if you so desire. And with that, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right, thanks for tuning in. Let's talk about Candyman. Come back next week. We'll have another topic. We'll be right back.
Thank you.